The West tells one story about Russia. Vladimir Putin tells another.
It speaks to this very kind of messianic sense that Russia, through its suffering, has saved civilization time and time again, and therefore it's now owed something.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, Spain is still reeling from the worst flooding in a century. And in Rio, police officers go on trial.
Brazil has the chance to finally find closure and begin to heal one of its deepest wounds.
Plus, a rising star of Cuban music has people here in the U.S. getting down.
And she's got global appeal, but it's hard to put your finger on exactly why.
We all need a little cuteness, you know, in our lives. It's like, aw, she's adorable.
Yep, it's Hello Kitty, and she turns 50 this week.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The death toll in eastern Spain has climbed. More than 150 people have died in what authorities say is the worst flooding in a century.
Towns around the coastal city of Valencia were hardest hit. The village of Paiporta, in particular, saw jaw-dropping destruction.
Cars carried away by the water now lie piled up like toys. The flooding ripped out train tracks and washed away roads. So much sediment got washed out to sea that the nearby Mediterranean looks brown in satellite photos. The World's Jerry Haddon paid a visit to Paiporta and sent us this report.
On Paiporta's muddy streets, locals walk around with plastic bags tied around their shoes. They skirt fallen trees, debris, and everywhere, the smashed, overturned cars. Emergency vehicles speed back and forth. The sun's come out, and lots of people carry pails and shovels. We're going to a friend's place to help him dig out, says a young man who will only give his name as Ferran. Our friend lives on the ground floor, Ferran says, and right now you can't even get past his door. No one in Paiporta can remember a flash flood like this week's, because there hasn't been one, not this intense, triggered by a month's rain that fell in a single day. Paiporta sits near the beach at the end of a long depression that starts miles up in the hills. The record rainfall spilled over water storage basins and overran concrete flood channels. More than 40 people here were killed, most drowned in street-level apartments. Like the one Carmen Mencal and her family are sweeping out. There are several inches of soupy brown mud on the floor. When the water hit, Mencal says, I ran down to get the car in our ground floor garage. I thought I could save some important items, but I turned back, she says. If I tried to take it out, the water would have swept me away. Look at the watermark on the windows over there, she says, pointing across the street. People were clinging to the bars on those windows all night, 6 feet up until the water went down. People, she says, were climbing trees. It hit like a tsunami, says resident Omar Martinez. He escaped in his car by a miracle, he says. It just came and swept everything away. Horses, farm animals, and Martinez says his dog, Dandy. Like a lot of people, Martinez says he's still in shock and wondering how this happened. He blames regional authorities.
Por la fuerte lluvia recomendada permanezcan en sus casas o viviendas en zonas próximas, barrancos o ramblas.
Martinez reads me an emergency message the government sent to his phone the night of the flood. Stay inside, it says, avoid low-lying areas, wait for more instructions. Problem is, Martinez says, this first warning arrived at 9 p.m.
A las 8 de la tarde ya estábamos inundados.
By then, he says, my house was already completely flooded. There was nothing we could do. Government officials have been on TV and the radio insisting they reacted as fast as they could. They knew a storm was coming, they say, just not a storm like this. Atmospheric physicist Manuel de Castro says they should get used to it.
Lo que también es prácticamente seguro para la ciencia.
Speaking on Spanish public radio today, he said it's a scientific fact that these autumn storms will be more intense. The reasons, he says, are related to climate change. The water in the Mediterranean is getting hotter, and hotter means more energy gets pumped into storm clouds when they form. De Castro says the only thing the government can really do is get the warning messages out earlier and make them more persuasive so that people act on them. It's curious, he says, because just weeks ago there was a hurricane in the U.S. and the people paid attention to the storm warnings. Officials evacuated hundreds of thousands of people. It's a lesson for us here in Spain. De Castro says it's too late for the other solution, rebuilding the urban landscape to respect the natural ravines and floodplains in the area. So the residents of Paiporta will clean up, knowing another devastating storm could strike. In this one, they lost dozens of neighbors, friends, relatives, and pets. Today, they're desperate for one thing.
Falta mucha agua.
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 Sin agua y sin gas, agua. Queremos agua.
Drinking water, everyone says. A mother of two named Estela Los says there's no gas or water in her home, so she can't cook for her two little girls. She's pushing them on the street in a muddy stroller. Los and her husband Antonio join a line for ready-to-eat meals and bottled water being handed out by soldiers. We're going to take the kids to our relatives in Valencia, says Antonio, but I'm coming back to help. The whole town is wrecked, says Los, holding back tears. Rebuilding it will take several months at least, says Spain's central government. It's declared a state of emergency. The town of Paiporta itself is observing 3 days of official mourning for those killed and those still missing. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Paiporta, Spain.
And we've got a quick update for you on the latest from Lebanon and Israel, where intense fighting continues after Israel's invasion of southern Lebanon earlier this month. Today, 7 people in Israel were killed by rockets that Hezbollah launched from Lebanon. 4 foreign workers were among the casualties. Meanwhile, the Israeli military told people to evacuate more areas in southern Lebanon. That's after Israeli airstrikes killed at least 8 people there last night. Hezbollah's newly named leader, Naim Qassem, said the militant group will keep fighting until it's offered a ceasefire deal that it deems acceptable.
All these developments have unfolded at the same time as mediators have been renewing efforts to halt the war in Lebanon and the war in the Gaza Strip. New proposals have been circulating that would wind down the regional conflicts. As fighting continues, though, so does the dire humanitarian situation, especially for people in Gaza. Tomorrow on The World, we'll have a look at what it means in Gaza to have aid dip to its lowest level in more than a year of fighting.
Whether you know it or not, you live in Hello Kitty's world.
She comes from a wonderful world of fantasy. It's Hello Kitty!
The iconic character, born in Japan, turns 50 tomorrow. Simple round lines, dots for eyes, no mouth. Across the globe, Hello Kitty has generations of fans and generations of merchandise. Pencil erasers in the 20th century, selfie filters in the 21st. She was born as a simple design with no backstory. And yet, such long-lasting appeal worldwide. Hello Kitty's enduring popularity is a subject Leslie Bowe thinks a lot about. She's a professor of English and Asian American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
So her origin story really, you know, begins in Japan in the kind of economic boom where people had disposable income. And Japan's also a gift-giving culture. So part of the origin story is that it began with stationery that was really aimed, and she was a mascot for these stationery store started by Sanrio. You know, and basically, you know, she was just a figure that made these items more appealing and attractive to especially young girls and women.
Right. As you say, she was created basically just as a design. She did not start off as a cartoon like Mickey Mouse or something like that. Her backstory was only added later after she was already popular, right?
Right. So technically, she is not a cat. She's a girl. She's English. Her name is Kitty White, and she lives in London. And, you know, I think that's such an interesting, you know, backstory because, you know, part of the whole tradition of manga and anime coming out of Japan really had its start in Disney, you know, characters. So the style, you know, was based on Bambi, you know, the gigantic eyes, you know, and such. And so that's part of the interconnection for the what you might call the deterritorialization of this Japanese character. So she was already situated as, in retrospect, as global at the moment that she was coming out onto the scene.
I just want to backtrack for a moment and mention, you said that Hello Kitty is actually not a kitty, she's a girl. A lot of her fans still consider her a cat, but somewhat recently, the first creator of Hello Kitty, Shimizu Yuko, said to the BBC that she was a little girl and not a cat, and fans kind of freaked out about that.
Yes, that was in response to Christine Yano's book on pink globalization and Hello Kitty. And yes, that there was a huge, you know, reaction to that. And to me, you know, cat or girl, you know, she still reflects this kind of cute style, which is a very specific, you know, aesthetic. And if I could talk a little bit about what that is supposed to signify, you know, the marketability is about a specific kind of appeal. You know, like, why are these, you know, like little cute things? So they're little, they're cute, they have a very rounded shape. Shaped like babies, you know, so circular. They have a very minimalist cartooning style. So not a whole lot of lines, no shading whatsoever. And they really are to stimulate this idea of, oh, they look like babies. They need to be taken care of. They stimulate, you know, the kind of protective feelings. And I think that that is the essence of not just Hello Kitty, but a lot of these characters who came after her as well.
You've mentioned the word kwaii a few times, which roughly translates to what, cuteness, but it is this whole aesthetic in Japan. Can you tell me more about that?
Actually started as a kind of populist movement among, 14-year-old or so Japanese girls who had affected this kind of loopy, rounded style of writing that was called kanekoji or kitten style. And then, you know, it kind of spread into a corporate, you know, movement. And now you see it all over Japan and even these localized forms. One of the things that I talk about a lot in my talks is, you know, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin, and I walk down the street to go home and I pass by the Target and they have a localized mascot, which our mascot is a badger and we live in the state capital. So they have a very cute depiction of a badger and a cute depiction of the Capitol Dome smiling happily, waving at us, you know, and I just like think, okay, you know, 1970s Japan, you know, to here walking down the street in the Midwest with these little cute things. And I'm just going to explain
it. There is, appropriately enough, a cat in the background to us.
Just let her out.
That's just perfect. You said that these cute characters were kind of born out of the bubbly, pretty writing of teenage girls. So never underestimate the power of the teenage girl, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's most fascinating to me is when you read about the history of cute style, you know, it wasn't a corporate movement. You know, it was a movement that girls in Japan were actually creating for themselves, right? Creating, you know, a sense of difference or a sense of something that was their own, you know, and I think that the irony of that, that there are really gendered formations, right, that go into the consumption of cute goods. And certainly one of those, in terms of her theory, is that these girls did not want to grow up, right? So that actually the consumption of things that are associated with childhood constituted a resistance to taking on the more defined and responsible and circumscribed roles of women in Japan.
You've touched on this throughout this conversation, but there have been countless characters and cartoons created since Hello Kitty was born 50 years ago. Why does she remain so very popular? What is it about her that is so enduring?
You can have lots of academic, you know, conversations about that, right? And at another level, it's like, oh, come on.
She's so cute.
She is so cute. The bow. And of course, my last name being Bow, I like gravitate towards that one. So I can intellectualize all this stuff about kwaii. But at the end of the day, I think my desire towards that is the same as yours. It's like, oh, she's adorable.
That's Leslie Bow, professor of English and Asian American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, revealing so many layers to the global appeal of Hello Kitty, who turns 50 tomorrow.
You're listening to The World. Hello, Marco Werman here. Democracy is at the top of our minds this month with a number of countries holding national and regional elections, including the United States. Here at The World, we believe strongly that human-centered journalism is at the heart of an informed public and a strong democracy. We see democracy and journalism as two sides of the same coin. And if you care about one, it is imperative to care about the other. Every day, our nonprofit newsroom goes beyond breaking news to share human insights from the people living the stories that make headlines. This personalized approach, reporting on the ground and prioritizing the voices of real people, does not come cheap. It takes time and energy to find those guests with those experiences and is only possible because of the support of listeners like you. So as we kick off our fall fundraiser, I'm asking for your support of this critical work. From now until the end of the year, we are striving to raise $67,000, and we need your help to get there. Please go to theworld.org/give or visit the link in our episode notes to give today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you for believing in journalism that strengthens our democracy. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Yesterday, in a courtroom in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, two police officers appeared before a judge. The men are charged with the 2018 assassination of a city councilwoman and her driver in Rio. Outside the courthouse, supporters called for justice.
Justiça!
Marielle Franco is the name of the city councilwoman who was killed. The assassination made her a household name throughout Brazil. The ensuing investigation turned up allegations of endemic corruption, including ties between local politicians, police, and well-armed gangs. Letícia Duarte has been following the trial. She's a Brazilian journalist based in New York.
Yeah, Marielle was a local city council in Rio de Janeiro. And when she was alive, she was a rising star on the left fighting for human rights. She was a Black, bisexual, feminist, raised in the favela, slums in Brazil, and she was elected on a platform for minorities. So she was fighting for everything that the extreme rights rejects, everything that symbolizes the minorities in Brazil fighting for more justice, more equality.
Now, one of the men, you alluded to this, has implicated some politicians and a police chief in this assassination plot. What is exactly being alleged?
We had these two brothers, Brazil brothers, Domingos and Chiquinho Brazão. One of them was Marielle's colleague in the Rio de Janeiro City Council. And the other one was also part of this militia. They are working together. And according to the ones that are being in trial right now, they hired them because they wanted to stop. Marielle had voted against trying to legalize one of these projects related to the expansion of the militia's land and properties in Rio. And Marielle was leading the opposition to these plans. So they decided to kill her as a message.
And these militias, I mean, they're essentially well-armed criminal gangs, right?
Yeah, but what's particular in Brazil is that they are organized gangs, but they have this strong arm in the police. So we had many police officers involved, and that's why they are so powerful. And it's not a coincidence that we have two former cops involved in this crime. They are part of these militias and in close link also with politicians. As we know, they're also the masterminds for this crime.
I mean, how significant is it that the former police chief and these two politicians were implicated by one of the alleged assassins?
I think it says a lot about Brazil and how complicated these issues are, because as we were speaking before, these militias are also in the core of the political system and the police system. So we see how this corruption is so intricate and how hard it is to fight. They are really sure that they would never be caught because the police chief was involved in the plot. So there, since the beginning, the police chief was trying to obstruct the investigation. And so everybody, all the politicians involved, the cops involved, they were all so sure that they would never be caught or punished. So now I think was really important because this trial is finally an opportunity from the state to give an answer to this violence and to show that the story can be different, to show that the murder of human rights defenders like Marielle will not go unpunished, will not be forgotten.
I mean, this is one case. I'm just wondering how much energy is the government of Lula da Silva putting into taking away kind of this power of the police in Brazil at a national level and endemic corruption?
Yeah, what's deeply frustrated is that after Marielle's assassination, nothing really changed structurally. Political and police violence in Brazil are still huge and going up even. Of course, after Marielle's assassination, we had the government of Bolsonaro, a far-right president, that was really promoting this idea that police should kill the criminals. So we had this state official policy empowering these extrajudicial killings. And Lula's government now, being a leftist government, has this narrative and policies pro-human rights, but it's really hard to fight against this structural problems that have been in Brazil for so many years.
Letícia, let me end with a question about what's become of the issues that Marielle Franco championed in Rio de Janeiro. I mean, she was an advocate for people living in the favelas, the poorest parts of town. She spoke out against gangs and police violence. Where do those issues stand now?
I don't think much has changed, unfortunately, but Marielle's memory is a symbol of resistance, and I think she inspires people to keep fighting. And the fact that now we have a leftist government again in power and some of Marielle's allies in power in the government, it's a symbol that they maybe have more hope in the horizon. But there's, as we were talking before, the history of the country and structures of power, it won't change like from one day to another. But at least with this trial, if you get justice, this will be a big, important response that society is expecting to see justice and to show that these cases won't go unpunished.
Letícia Duarte is a Brazilian journalist based in New York. She's following the trial of two former police officers charged in the killing of Brazilian civil rights icon Marielle Franco. That trial began this week in Rio de Janeiro.
An aspiring doctor works hard, gets into medical school, only to drop out to become a musician.
That's what happened to Eric Alejandro Iglesias Rodriguez. He was studying medicine in his hometown in Cuba, Pinar del Rio.
Rodriguez moved to Havana in 2010 to pursue a career in music, eventually adopting the name Simafunk.
And guess what? His change in career has paid dividends. Simafunk's bringing his hip-hop, funk, and Afro-Cuban sounds to the U.S. He's on tour right now. The rising star has caught the attention of notable music legends like Paul McCartney and the godfather of funk himself, George Clinton. In fact, Simafunk and Clinton have collaborated on a few tunes, including this recent track, I Don't Care.
Not bad for a former med student, now Cuba's next big thing in music.
I care about I don't care. That's music from Eric Alejandro Iglesias Rodriguez, also known as Simafunk, to get you moving. More global news and stories are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
An island seeks sovereignty, and it has something the rest of the world wants.
The resources in that mine are today worth over $100 billion. I didn't say million, I said $100 billion.
And the author of a new book about Vladimir Putin lets us in on what the Russian leader is thinking. Ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. For the first time in 15 years, Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party has lost its absolute majority in the lower house of parliament in snap elections held over the weekend. Reporter Rebecca Rossman in Tokyo finds out what comes next for the party after this major political setback. When it comes to politics, Japan has long been known for its stability. The conservative Liberal Democratic Party has kept a tight grip on power for the majority of years since the Second World War. On Sunday, however, that grip started to loosen after the party's setback, plunging the country into a new and unfamiliar era of uncertainty. As the results came in, Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba, who took office earlier this month, said he would not resign, but was taking the results seriously. Here he is on Japanese broadcaster NHK.
I think the people of Japan are telling us to reflect on what we have done and change ourselves to better listen to the will of the people.
Japan has been facing rising inflation, wage stagnation, and for the LDP in particular, there has been a series of embarrassing financial corruption scandals. Voters are frustrated and wanted to send the party a clear message.
This is definitely more than a slap on the wrist.
Tobias Harris is the founder of Japan Foresight, a political risk consultancy focused on Japanese politics.
It wasn't even so much about the sums of money. It was much more about the sense of lawlessness or just, you know, corrupt practices that showed that even as ordinary people were struggling with inflation, with cost of living increases, here was the LDP just doing whatever it wanted, you know, because it helped it hold power.
The LDP now has 30 days to form a ruling coalition if it can. Meanwhile, the Constitutional Democrats, the main opposition party, gained 50 seats. Another sign voters were shifting support from Japan's main conservative party to its liberal alternative. Here in Tokyo's Harajuku neighborhood, I speak to 30-year-old Kanoko Tsuchiya, who tells me she is amongst those who voted for the opposition. Tsuchiya says she's not surprised by the results, but isn't so optimistic that the LDP has learned its lesson that voters are frustrated.
I don't know if they're really angry for what they have been doing for like last 10 or 20 years. I think we'll have to see if the change will last.
Many voters here in Japan are jaded, even LDP loyalists. 23-year-old Tomotaka Sato tells me he voted for LDP in his home prefecture of Niigata. But he's not that big a fan of Prime Minister Ishiba. Rather, he longs for the days of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Shinzo Abe was a prime minister and he had a good economy politics.
Abe's signature Abenomics policies were what helped pull Japan out of a recession back in 2012. But in Sunday's elections, less than 54% of eligible voters turned up, the lowest rate since the end of World War II. Perhaps for the first time in decades, voters are showing their discontent. Tobias Harris says there's a lot of frustration in Japan right now.
And it's not really clear how this kind of hung parliament situation is going to make people more satisfied with the democracy and how it's working and how people are represented. And so it's likely that we're going to see a kind of chaotic situation in Japanese democracy for some time to come.
In other words, Harris says the LDP's new job isn't just about finding more coalition partners to help it govern. The party also has a job to convince voters that they are still worthy of their trust. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Tokyo.
A future powered by clean energy would require lots of copper for solar panels and electric cars. That, in turn, could be hugely beneficial for the Pacific island of Bougainville, the territory of Papua New Guinea.
It has been called a treasure island because it has the largest copper deposits on Earth. The people who live in Bougainville fought hard to keep mining corporations away, but welcoming big business might help them achieve their dream of independence.
The World's Patrick Wynn traveled on assignment to Bougainville, and this week he's bringing us dispatches from an island on the cusp of change. Today, whether the road to sovereignty could be paved with copper.
It's drizzling in Panguna town, which is more like the skeleton of a town, with storefronts charred black by war. Crumbling facades reveal stairways that ascend to nowhere. I do see life stirring in a ruined apartment building. A woman comes out and tells me her name.
Balbina, B-A-L-B-I-N-A.
How old are you now, Balbina?
57 years.
Okay. She was just a kid back in the 80s, when this town was one of the richest in Papua New Guinea and filled with foreigners, mostly Australians.
And we used to go to their houses. We were invited, socializing with the white people. If any one of our classmates had birthday parties, we'll all go and join in. It was nice.
Gazing down Main Street, Balbina envisions the town that once was. The supermarket, the bank, the Olympic-sized swimming pool, now filled with algae. When we reach a stone building devoured by mold, Balbina squints, transporting herself back in time.
During good times, This is the entrance of the cinema.
Where do you buy popcorn?
Okay, not popcorn, but ice cream and milkshake. Somewhere here. That's where we used to buy it, and then we get inside.
I ask Balbina where she sleeps today. She points back to the apartments, long vacated by her foreign childhood friends. The roof has since collapsed.
When it rains, water drips down like river flowing. Not like the time when BCL was operating.
BCL means Bougainville Copper Limited, a former subsidiary of the mining conglomerate Rio Tinto. This was a mining town, built next to what was the most profitable copper mine on Earth. I'd like to see the old mine, but foreigners can't wander around here. Not anymore. One of Balbina's relatives, Sylvia, agrees to take me. We're rumbling up a pebbly road in a truck. Up front is Sylvia Masson. In her early 50s, she is at the top of what Bougainvillians call a clan, comprising thousands of people.
Yeah, I'm the boss here. I'm the landowner here.
All 300,000 Bougainvillians belong to a clan, each sworn to protect ancestral terrain. Most clans are matrilineal, so Sylvia Masson is the shot caller on any decision affecting her people's land, or what's left of it. Wow. It looks like an atomic bomb went off here, vaporizing a mountain, leaving a giant crater.
Just look at those mountains. Yeah. That's how far they can dig down. So you just imagine this.
The mine scooped out more than a billion tons of copper-rich earth, spreading it across the world, where it went into furniture and appliances and jewelry in wealthier places. Sylvia Masson's clan saw how the foreigners lived up in Panguna Town, with their tidy homes and their squash courts, while locals lived in huts.
We were getting poor and poor, while other countries were getting richer out of our Bougainville land.
In 1988, her clan, on the orders of its women, sparked a revolt that spread island-wide. In response, Papua New Guinea, with Australian backing and guns, sent troops, in part to save the Western-owned mine. The fighting was horrific.
I had killing right in front of my eyes. They were just killing like you're killing the animal or shooting the dogs down.
After 10 bloody years and up to 20,000 deaths, the locals won control of their land. Now, there's still a lot of copper in that mine. They're sitting on a fortune.
The resources in that mine are today worth over $100 billion. I didn't say million, I said $100 billion.
John Coons is a former Wall Street banker. He's lived on Bougainville, off and on, for nearly a decade.
It's at what I call the end of the world, way, way down in the South Pacific. Basically, from New York City, it takes about 40 hours to get there. Nobody really is familiar with anything going on in Bougainville.
Hardly anyone on Wall Street. Coons, through his investment firm, Numa Numa Resources, is trying to convince investors it's not only safe to come back, it's foolish not to. America needs Bougainville, he says, almost as much as Bougainville needs the U.S.
It's great for everyone to say we want a massive fleet of electric vehicles and we want AI, we want computation to reach to the moon. All of that involves specialty metals.
Especially copper. Nothing conducts electricity like it. Yet the world is running low on copper. Big tech is starving for more.
There's going to have to be a bunch of big holes dug around the earth, and people aren't going to like that. The good thing about Bougainville is the hole's already dug.
That's footage of its dirt and ore, scooped out by cranes. It was filmed by Australia's government decades ago. Balbina, who I met in Panguna Town, she witnessed it as a schoolgirl. She also saw the mine's toxic waste transform her drinking water, a mountain stream.
Our nice rivers and where we used to catch crabs and fish, we noticed, hey, how comes the river is blue? It was frightening.
That stream is still blue today, a freakish Windex blue. This perversion of the natural world pains the people of this mountain. Many say they've already sacrificed so much land and so much life. So this must lead to some higher purpose.
If we really open the mine, it could provide for the building of the nation, building half of the nation.
That's another local clan leader, Wendy Bawara. And she doesn't mean the nation of Papua New Guinea, which was gifted Bougainville by its old colonizer, Australia, in 1975, against the islanders' wishes. No, no, no. She's talking about starting a new nation, the Republic of Bougainville.
In 10 years' time, Bougainville would be another Singapore. Another USA, your word.
You sound hopeful.
Yeah, and I'm always dreaming that one fine day, Bougainville will be like U.S.
Hope is sweeping this island like a fever. It has been for 5 years, since the United Nations backed a referendum, asking Bougainvillians if they want independence. 98% said yes. Today, independence is prematurely celebrated in song. Here's a local reggae band, The Offsprings. Sounds great, but at the moment, Bougainville can barely keep the lights on. It survives off aid from Australia, Papua New Guinea, a bit from the U.S., and its economy is microscopic, worth less than $500 million a year, mostly exporting cocoa and coconuts. To fund a nation, they'll have to reopen that mine. Take it from President Ismail Toroama, a former rebel who is now the island's elected political leader.
The people have voted for independence. We have to guarantee that independence through economic activity.
If his voice sounds familiar, that was him singing just a moment ago. Yep, the president has a reggae band. As for economic activity, he means letting an outside corporation mine the copper-rich Panguna Mountain, the very one he and his rebels once fought to shut down.
We can now use Panguna. You want to help me with my independence? I will be sharing the shares of Panguna.
Sharing with whom? Well, he says, China keeps calling. It needs copper bad. China's producing more green energy than anywhere else. Bougainville Copper Limited, the former mine owner, also wants a piece of the action. And then there's American investor John Koons. He is avowedly pro-Bougainville independence and thinks the U.S. government should be too.
The United States would be out of its mind to let this opportunity pass.
The White House should drive aid and investment towards Bougainville, he says. Though he does understand Washington is currently fixated on who will win the race for U.S. president.
After the election, whoever is in charge has to take the initiative with respect to Bougainville, or they're going to lose a great opportunity.
Koon says if he helps reopen the mine, roughly half its profits would stay on the island, enriching indigenous clans, paying for schools, hospitals, a power grid, everything a new nation needs. Before the uprising, Bougainvillians got only about 2% of the mining profits.
I've developed infrastructure in remote corners of the world, all over Central America, South America, People's Republic of China. I've never encountered a situation like Bougainville, which is they're very mistrusting of foreigners for good reason.
The other mining companies declined to tell me how they might benefit Bougainville, but all would have to prove they're not going to further devastate the environment. No matter who gets it, it's hard to imagine President Ismail Toroama accepting a raw deal from anyone. In his rebel days, he took a bullet and grenade shrapnel to defend his people from a Fortune 500 corporation. He tells me, ideally, a Western firm would reopen the mine, to help make things right.
You guys owe Bougainville. You have to give back to Bougainville. But what I'm saying is we have to do it the Bougainville way.
The Bougainville way is quite democratic. Under the island's own laws, the president can't cut a deal by himself. Whoever comes for that copper must also satisfy the matrilineal clans, ladies like Sylvia Masson and Wendy Bawara, the true guardians of this sacred land. At the rim of the mine, Wendy and Sylvia look down into that yawning chasm. It's not a pretty sight.
I think my ancestors would be, they won't be proud, they will be very worried. So even now, maybe in the graveyard, they are really worried because one big mountain just got lost. And now there's a huge hole.
Bougainville's future depends on that hole, on outsiders with expertise extracting that wealth. Only this time, Sylvia Masson says, they'd better share it. So to anyone that wants to come here and do it the old way.
No, we don't want to pack up and leave.
Stay home.
Stay home. Oh, the ladies might start the crisis.
She's laughing, but no joke. Try to swindle Bougainville, and these ladies will call upon their clans to resist. Again. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bougainville.
As Patrick has reported, Bougainville wants the U.S. as an ally and has offered a military base on the island as enticement. But Bougainville is waiting for an answer from Washington.
And if nothing is forthcoming from U.S., the Chinese are there. The Chinese have already spoken to me.
The U.S., China, and Bougainville's future. Join us tomorrow for that story and check out Patrick's photos from the Pacific Island at theworld.org.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Vladimir Putin reportedly has three advisors, Ivan the Terrible, Peter I, and Catherine the Great. At least that's what his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, flippantly told a reporter after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. The anecdote speaks to Putin's obsession with his version of Russian history and his legacy in that story. So says Mark Galliotti, a scholar of Russian security affairs. He writes about all of this in his new book, Forged in War, A Military History of Russia from Its Beginnings to Today. Galliotti told me how Putin thinks about Russian identity in terms of conquest.
You've got to understand that this is a country at the crossroads of Europe and Asia, in which essentially whichever is the military power of the age, whether we're talking about the Mongols in the 14th century or Napoleon in the 18th, will at some point feel the need to come through Russia. And I think from that and various other factors to do with the lack of natural borders, relative poverty, there has been this sense in Russia that it is constantly under threat and that therefore in those circumstances, if you're going to go into a fight, you better throw the first punch. And in fact, this is exactly what Putin himself said that he learned running with youth gangs in his own childhood. So, well, without in any way wanting to justify, for example, things like the terrible current war in Ukraine, there is that sense of Russia constantly being caught in wars because it feels, rightly or wrongly, that it has no alternative.
It is hard to talk about all of this and Russia without talking about the current war in Ukraine. I mean, the latest developments are pretty stunning, in particular the arrival of North Korean troops in Russia's Kursk region. What can you tell us about those reinforcements?
This is at once a big deal and a small deal. It's a big deal in that the first time we're actually seeing foreign troops joining the war. But on the other hand, look, even the most extreme claims say that there's 12,000 of these North Korean troops. That's the number of losses that the Russians are taking in 10 days of the fighting. So this is not the kind of thing that is going to turn the war. But nonetheless, it does say something about how Russia is in some ways trying to expand its war, look to its rather bizarre collection of pariah state allies, and see how it can draw on them to grind down the Ukrainians.
What is your sense of the difference in military culture, how this might work, and whether it will work?
North Korean troops, and we have to realize they haven't had combat experience, so they are well-drilled and well-physically trained, but they certainly are not geared to the kind of modern war that we've seen in Ukraine, a war which has been evolving at incredible speed with the use of drones and electronic warfare and the like. Apparently, there's one interpreter for every 30 soldiers. That's not that many. So I think one of the reasons why I think the Russians are more likely to use these people as sort of rear area security troops rather than front line is because the chances of miscommunication and friendly fire must be massive in those circumstances.
And then, of course, there's this big question. What does Putin have to offer in exchange to North Korea or to two other Russian allies that are helping it in Ukraine, China and Iran?
The bottom line is none of this is being given out of the kindness of anyone's heart. What Putin is having to do is basically rent his friends. And for North Korea, he's offering food, he's offering spare parts, and he's also offering technology. And we're already seeing that. The North Koreans have just tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile.
Very transactional and practical, it sounds like. I mean, it's a good segue to get back to one of the themes in your book. You write, to Putin, his invasion of Ukraine was not an imperial adventure, but a necessary act of self-defense. Mark, walk us through Putin's logic or reasoning. What is the basis for that belief?
Well, I mean, I very much see Putin as almost a 19th century geostrategist in that he has this very outdated notion of the world that is not only divided between great powers and the rest, and from his point of view, Russia, of course, has the right to be considered a great power, but also that the world is divided between those countries that give orders and those countries that take them. It's a very colonial notion. We know from his writings and his bizarre pseudo-historical essays that he doesn't really believe Ukraine is a country and that the Ukrainians are not a real people. And from his point of view, he sees a country that ought to be part of Russia's sphere of influence has been stolen by the West. And so he feels he's rolling in to take it back.
I mean, you basically present Ukraine as one of many examples of Russia perceiving threats from every direction. So is Russian insecurity at the heart of this current war?
Remember, you know, Putin and his closest allies and cronies, they're pretty much all between the ages of sort of 68 and 74. In other words, they're all Homo Sovieticus generation. They're all people who grew up in the Soviet Union, believing they were part of a superpower, not really being able to cope when it fell apart. And that has kind of metastasized into a sense that someone stole it from us, that somehow the collapse of the Soviet Union, it wasn't because of ill-fated reform, economic stagnation and everything else. No, it was because somehow the West maneuvered and manipulated that.
So we mentioned earlier how Catherine the Great is reportedly an important figure for Putin's concept of power. Catherine the Great, though, famously was westward-facing, enthralled with the Enlightenment, with France, and adapted Western values and innovations into Russian culture. How do you square that for Putin's worldview?
You're absolutely right. Catherine the Great very much wanted to see Russia modernized and westernized. But the elements of Catherine the Great that Putin looks to, well, she famously said, "I have no way of defending my borders but expanding them." And Catherine the Great took part in a whole series of aggressive imperial wars, because not least because that was how monarchs disported themselves in those days.
So Putin is fond of hearkening back to a lesson he says he learned running with street gangs in post-war Leningrad. You mentioned this. If a threat is looming, it's best to strike first. You say in your book that that way of thinking, what you call a cult of vulnerability, is actually bad for Russia. There are many Russians, I am told, who hunger to see an alternate worldview. Do you think Russia could move beyond this way of thinking that you seem to be arguing has been hardwired for centuries?
In the modern age, in the nuclear age, there is no real reason for Russia to feel that kind of vulnerability. And many, I mean, look, I sort of talked long in the night over lots and lots of alcohol, for example, even with Russian army officers. And they will admit that they live in a different world now. But as I say, I think from Putin's point of view, he is part of this, I don't really want to call them traumatized, but let's say a generation who have been thoroughly messed up by that inability to adapt to a post-superpower era. And look, end of empire is hard. You know, Britain has taken decades to start to begin to shed it. France, likewise. We shouldn't have thought that it was going to be easy for the Russians. And my only hope is that this awful war in Ukraine can in some ways be the catalyst, a little bit like the Suez Crisis when Britain realized it was no longer a great empire, or the Algerian War that did the same for the French. This may be the moment at which the Russians can actually begin to metabolize their new status.
Mark Galeotti's new book is Forged in War, A Military History of Russia from Its Beginnings to Today.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Happy Halloween, y'all.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Carol Boschka, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, Janae Elzey, Kira and Peter McGrath. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.